Right, welcome to the programme. Resident musicologist Sid Griffin. How are you, sir?
I'm well, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Yeah, in fact, Grant Scrivener has been on, which is an excellent name.
All right.
Grant Scrivener. He says, I've cycled through a drive-thru before a day out on the bike to get a cheeseburger, without which I would struggle to get home. I had 5 miles to go and had totally run out of food and energy. The girl serving was pretty amused. Also, as you have Sid Griffin on today's show, I once heard a cover of a famous Long Riders song retitled Looking for Kimberly Clark, a note to the travails of finding yourself bereft of toilet paper in a public convenience. Are you aware of this?
Not only am I not aware of it, I've never seen a bean for it. Let's get going here. Let's get to the bottom of this one.
Looking for Lewis and Clark, because they are one of the Long Riders tunes, but looking for Kimberly Clark. Yes, I've never heard it. What have you been up to? Have you been out and about with the Cole Porters?
Yeah, the Cole Porters have been playing. We played a couple, three times this weekend. It was great. And I'm doing you know, when we had that guy on, I talked about Last Shop Standing, the great book by Graham Jones.
Yes, indeed.
He has been ever so grateful to you, me, and to Stuart, because his book was sort of there, and we were the first people in national media to mention it. Now,
right.
It's done very well, and as your listeners may well know, it's now a film, and it's being shown in, get ready, Mark, 85 theaters in the UK and Canada and the United States of America.
Great.
For Record Store Day this weekend, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 85 theaters are going to show his documentary, Last Shop Standing, which is about the demise of the record store.
Right.
And I'm going to do a Q&A for that on Thursday here in London off Shaftesbury Avenue. So I hope the transport and the buses are working. I heard your announcement.
Well,
earlier.
The shuttle bus, yeah, apparently, the W1 shuttle bus is not
most going, disturbing to the
Street.
People of the north of England, I'm sure.
Yeah, and the west and the east and the deep south.
And Northern Ireland. But anyway, Thursday at the Curzon Theatre, we're going to show that film. There's a Q&A afterwards that I and more notable people than me are going to talk about it. So I think, pat on the back to you and Stuart, because that really got him on the mark with Last Shop Standing.
Oh, no, glad to have contributed to that. And we're talking about, you know, Record Store Day and everything.
It's such a great weekend.
A
great weekend. Such a great idea.
Great. Okay. Let's talk about this book.
Yeah, which,
classic tracks. The real stories behind 68 seminal recordings. We did question, well, 68 seemed an odd number. Dr. Giles Anderson, researching visual processes in Leamington Spa, said, I would suggest the reason this book goes to 68 rather than 75 is a similar reason why magazines only give you 52 ways to a perfect stomach. These are intentional, so it doesn't look like you've put some duff comments in there to make it up to a round number.
That's a good theory.
Focus groups have said people like it better that way. If it's just a bit random.
Because I kept doing the math of, does he consider it 68 years of pop music?
Yeah, no, I was trying to work it out.
That doesn't work out either. And I looked at the picture of author Richard Buskin in the back of the book as you hear me turn the pages. There's no way he's 68.
No.
So I couldn't figure it out either. But it caught my attention.
Yeah, yeah. So, guys, an interesting book and a handsome volume. So give us the lowdown on what it is.
Well, what it is he's taken 68 classic tracks and he talks about the recording of just that song. Now, he doesn't go in to say the entire hit. Let me just put my Bryan Adams, Run to You. He doesn't go into the whole LP or whatever. He just goes into that song by Bryan Adams. He doesn't do all of Brothers in Arms, Dire Straits. He just does Money for Nothing. Talking Heads, he just does the one song, Road for Nowhere. Queen is dead.
Van
Smith.
Morrison, he just does Moondance. So he just played a track from Moondance.
And he picks that as a classic song of that artist, of that genre, of that year. Mm. And he's done a pretty good darn representative cross-section. And then he really gets into what's going on with the track, and he interviews either an engineer and or the producer and people in the band. And it gets kind of heady after a while. I mean, I've just turned the page. If you'll follow in your hymn book to page 350, he's talking about, and the time of Justice for All, one of was equipped with an E-Series 48-channel SSL 4000.
Yeah. No, there is plenty of technical info.
JBL 431, it really gets technical at
it
parts.
It really gets technical. I mean, in fact, is this one on Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, 1985. There's a great picture of John Ilsley on bass in the studio, surrounded by about 3,000 guitars of Knopfler's. But also, there's a little drawing that they've got from somewhere of who was where in the studio, and like where the mics were, which, you know, it is quite interesting.
It is amazing. Now, I don't want to turn anybody off here, but Mr. Buskins did a great job. The white pages, he has about four or five white pages of text that talks in a very folksy, warm manner about the track and the personalities involved in it and all that. And what Mark and I are talking about now, dear listeners, is a blue page with white type on it, or a gray page with white type in some instances, that does get awfully technical. And if you don't know that it's Neumann microphones and not Neumann microphones and that kind of thing, if you didn't know what the reference to SSL was, you don't really need to read that page, unless you're a home recording fanatic. But the stuff on, be it the Police or Knopfler or Aretha Franklin or Les Paul and Mary Ford, it's on the white pages that deals more with the aesthetic of the art itself and the personalities. It's just terrific.
But one of the interesting things, let's talk about Blondie, because we're going to play a Blondie classic, Hanging on the Telephone. I was reading that, and it's a good interview with Mike Chapman.
Yes.
They produce an interesting character, where you're only examining one song, but actually it reveals loads about the relationships, and not least musically, and sort of the jealousies that arose from that within the band of who was a good player and who emphatically was not.
Well, I think that's what captures my imagination as I flipped through, captured my imagination as I ripped through this book, because he really does get into these bands, and it proves something my dear friend and drummer buddy Greg Souders, now a publishing mogul in California, says. Greg Souders says, "Sid, get with it. All bands are dysfunctional." And I disagreed with him when he told me this 4 or 5 years ago. Now I agree. It's amazing. It's very sad. Here's a quote I highlighted in yellow ink. "None of them liked each other except Chris and Debbie. And there was so much animosity." End of... It's true. It's in so many bands, but it's sad to read as you go through page. Somebody didn't like this guy, the bass player, you know, and it's just very sad. But it gives you a real snapshot of not just the interpersonal dynamics of Blondie or whatever band we're talking about, but the pressure these people are under once they get to a certain point in their careers.
Yeah.
Blondie had done a couple of records. They'd done well. They were a bit of a name over in Blighty over here. Well done. You all embraced them before the Yanks did. And they're under some real pressure. Terry Ellis's assignment for Mr. Chapman was make them a hit, get them to the top of the charts. Mm. And the pressure must have been enormous. So, of course, it's getting a little dysfunctional. Of course, they're not getting along with each other.
Yeah, and I like that bit just because, you know, anybody's been in a band is intrigued about what the relationships are in the band. And it says that Frankie Infante was the good guitar player, but Stein, I've never been entirely sure which way it is, but Stein would not let Frank Infante play the guitar solos because he wanted to play the guitar solos. So Mike Chapman and Chris Stein would just spend hours overnight when everyone else has gone home getting those guitar solos.
So the best guitar player.
Just because Chris didn't want Frank Infante to be the lead guitar player.
I got a real kick out of that. I'm proud to say I've never done that. Good Lord. But it is amazing. And he comes into the point that what a great... Debbie Harry was a great singer, but I qualify that. She doesn't have a great range, but what she's got, she uses extraordinarily well as a vocalist. And he's got this highlighted quote, "Debbie is a great singer and a great vocal stylist with a beautifully identifiable voice. However, she's also very moody." Well, that describes most of the singers in this book. I was a little surprised that they pulled that one out for the large quote that it is.
I love that when they say, you know, he says that, then again, I love Chris. And he said, you know, I'd say to him, "Why do you even worry about playing the guitar when you're such a great songwriter? You can't be everything. Let Frankie play the solos." I was thinking about, I was looking through this book, which is very nicely laid out, that if Chris Stein has read that, his ego will be ill-served by the fact that on this page, you get a photo of Nigel Harrison, Frank Infante, Jimmy Destri, Clem Burke and Debbie Harry, not one of Chris.
And I couldn't figure that out. Isn't Chris sort of the main guy? There are bigger Blondie fans than Sid Griffin, but I thought, where the heck's the main guy?
I know,
He was sort of the brains behind the operation.
Should we hear it?
Yeah. Yes, please. "I'm in the phone booth, it's the one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just bring it off the floor. I know he's there, but I just gotta call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone."
Still sounds thrilling, doesn't it? Still sounds fresh, and you know, it's just got everything still.
It does. It's a song by Jack Lee. It's not written by anybody in Blondie. Jack Lee was a member of a band called The Nerves, and The Nerves were Jack Lee on guitar, Peter Case on bass, and Paul Collins on drums. Peter Case is the same Peter Case that's now a great Americana star.
Yeah.
A solo troubadour kind of guy, and Peter Case is the greatest. And Jack Lee wrote that. He wrote "Please Come Back and Stay." He's written several hits, and so Jack Lee's mainly. He made two indie LPs and sort of counts the beans these days because he's written, you know, three or four songs that are just like Kimberly Rue that are just out there in the pop music lexicon.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have to bust derriere in the way that he used to. That's just what you want.
Money you don't have to get out of bed for.
I think, what does Steve Earle call it, Mark? He calls it mailbox money,
right,
doesn't
yeah.
it? I didn't do anything. I went to the mailbox. Sid, there's a check.
Yeah.
You got to love that.
I never got that knack. It was like Nick Lowe with What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding.
Yes.
And I did ask him whether it was true because it was on the closing credits of The Bodyguard where he did get a check for £1 million without knowing it was on the soundtrack. And he denied that was so. But I think when pushed, admitted it was about 900 grand, I think.
Well, the soundtracks of that sold 20 million copies.
Exactly,
and I think it was North America and 3 million in the rest of the world. I saw the film on TV and didn't hear the song. You say it's on the credits?
Well, that's what Nick Lowe was told.
I didn't hear it.
Nick Lowe was told that it was in the film, and he was that's why he earned all this money. So he thought, well, I better go and see it. Went to see the film, thought, it's not in it. Presumably at this point, worrying that he's had 900 grand or whatever. I mean, you know.
Yeah, right.
False, leaves it. And people say, but did you not stay until the end? It's not even, I think, the first song on the credits. I think it's like the second song on the credit. So everybody's just kind of kicking over popcorn cartons and shuffling out by the time his song comes on. But it's great. But this book, a fantastic variety of stuff. You say it starts off.
Yes.
What I like, actually, about the random, it's not picked one from each year religiously and gone through. It's because you start off in 51 with Les Paul and Mary Ford. Then you jump to two records in 57, Miles Davis and Jerry Lee Lewis. Then we get the Ronettes, the Kinks, Dylan. And, it's a good selection of things.
I should apologize to everybody hearing me turn the pages of the book as I'm trying to keep up with you. But it's a very good selection. And one of the strengths is I tried to read as much of it as I could before I was on the show in case you asked me something about the Smiths or Paul Simon or, you know.
And it goes right up to this. It's got Rihanna and Justice and the XX.
And you learn something because I'm thinking, I'd better hear this track. It sounds awfully darn good. But he doesn't do frankly, people like myself do. I get in sort of a roots rock bag or a 1960s pop music bag, and I just sort of stay there. And I need to be blasted out of it sometime and have somebody remind me that the Pixies or Public Enemy or whoever have good music as well to get me out of the same rut that you have the tendency to get in. I think John Peel was one of the guys. John Peel said, I never had that DNA in my musical taste that always meant I have to listen to the Grateful Dead because I'm of that era.
Mm.
And I'm afraid I do have that a little bit. So looking at this wonderful book, Classic Tracks, I was reading things about Tricky. Now, you know, I know who he is, but I'm thinking maybe I better hear this so I can check him out on YouTube or whatever. Or Justice. What do I know about them? Nothing. Mm. But it's good to get into different acts. And that's his sort of smorgasbord Catholic taste is really taking it somewhere else than it was just the big baby boomer Bob Dylan, Beatles, Motown over and over and over.
Yeah. And it's handsomely laid out. I mean, it is the kind
of book.
As you say, there is a lot of really techie stuff, you know, which some will and some won't be interested in. But, you know, it is the kind of thing you'd like, you know, pick up and just read one entry. And you will learn something about that period of pop culture or about that band, won't you?
Which is the strength of it, because, you know, there's bigger fans of the Human League than myself, but I read their entry and it really was interesting how they came out of a sort of a desperate scene, and you wouldn't have picked that particular town, although we now know how many great acts have come out of there, to be a pop music mecca, and it kind of did have a real sound and a feel. And when I read the Human League thing and read about Philip Welby and those guys, I thought, hey, they really did have something going on. This guy's got a real point here. There's a reason some of those records have lasted so long, or the dynamic of the E Street Band in the Springsteen entry for the song Born in the USA. It really puts a different spin, and then when you hear the song again, Don't You Want Me, or Born in the USA, it gives you a certain, you're listening to it with new ears.
Yeah.
Even though we've all heard those songs 40, 50,000, you know what I mean?
Well, indeed, and not least, Donna Summer's Love to Love You, Baby, which is revealed in this book, was extended to enhance the sex life of the president of the record company.
Now, I had heard that and thought it was rubbish, and he validates that record industry rumor. He validates it. I thought that was just rubbish. But I thought, well done, that guy, for lasting that long. The Viagra years have been postponed.
Now, one of the interesting things they say, the techie stuff, is you probably don't need to know what microphones were used for what and everything, but you know the kind of advancement of pop music is it goes hand in hand with the sort of technological experimentation in recording. Now, it's probably true that Motown get less credit. I mean, Motown are kind of get all the credit they deserve for more or less everything. But as kind of advancing experimentation in recording with the techniques, Motown probably don't get the respect they deserve. It is said that, you know, that, I mean, they were kind of doing as much to move recording on as George Martin and the Beatles down there at Abbey Road.
Is Mr. Buskin, the author, makes that point. He says they were listening to Beatles records sonically, not just as fans or whatever. They're listening to the Beatles going, well, if they're doing that in England, what are we doing here? And it's a great ping pong, because many people talk about Lennon and McCartney listening to Brian Wilson listening to Lennon and McCartney, and the Pet Sounds Rubber Soul into Revolver into Sgt. Pepper battle. But the Motown guys had the same thing going on with the Fab Four, but from the angle of George Martin and Hurricane Smith and then Jeff Emmerich, the great engineers. And what's really great is the Beatles, you know, they turned up the recording of the bass and the kick drum on their records because McCartney went into the studio and said, look, Motown have a really good kick drum going on. Why can't we have that kick drum? And why can't my bass be louder here at the EMI studios? So and it's interesting, like the ping pong there.
That's right. And they were kind of innovative, because, you know, it's like some of the Motown backbeat records, they were sort of doing things like getting the snow chains off the car wheels and hammering them on the floor, weren't they?
Yeah, literally. And, you know, they had Motown for a 10-year stretch. Now, let's remember, Berry Gordy came off the production line of the automobile industry. He was hungry to get something going in the record industry. He was a blue-collar dude. And in the 10 years, 61 to 71, they had 110 top 10 USA hits. I mean, they were not fooling around. They had something going. And, of course, Hitsville, USA, their wonderful studio in Detroit, which is still open. You can still visit it, like you can visit Sun Studios on Union Avenue in Memphis. You can still go to Hitsville, USA. At one point, for year after year after year, their doors never closed and were never locked. They had 24-7 action going on.
Yeah.
Oh, I tell a lie. They had a big Christmas Eve party and then shut for like 36 hours before they ramped it up again.
Right. Okay.
How about that?
Well, we'll play one of the many products of that period from 66. And great talking to you. Do you know how much this book is? Because I'm not sure. I mean, it's a handsome thing. It's kind of, you know, a big paperback picture book, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a big book.
No, I'm looking furiously as I rattle more papers. And no, I don't have it. And my copy doesn't have a tag on
it. Mine doesn't either. But
for those people that listen to this show and go anywhere near record store might have it as well.
Yeah.
A bookshop. It is well worth looking at. Classic Tracks, Richard Buskin. It is worth looking for. And I should say this before I go. It's well written, too. He's not just some guy that's compiled facts. He can write. He's mastered the English language.
I think it's about £25.
Worth it.
No, I would say that's...
Thumbs up.
I would say that's fair, because it's got great pictures in it.
And it's heavy. And it's not a joke.
I know.
It's pretty much coffee table, yeah.
Okay, Sid, great talking to you as ever. Have you got any Cole Porter's gigs coming up this week?
Well, we're off to Sweden in May, and then there's some things in Wales at the end of May, and it's all hands to the till.
We'll talk to you before all that, no doubt.
Yeah, man.
Take care, mate.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye.